Good afternoon. So today we're going to talk about virtual memory, which is the most common modern way of implementing address spaces. There are other things that hardware has done to implement address spaces, which we won't talk about very much. And they're usually even simpler than virtual memory, but virtual memory is the dominant way because of sort of flexibility it provides. First, I'd like to talk a bit about the lab yesterday. So first, sorry for two typos in the lab, one of which was pretty unfortunate, where I meant to have code to set something to zero, and instead I forgot some spaces, and Markdown helpfully formatted the underscores as italicizing things, and it ended up not making sense. I gather the TAs mostly compensated for this by writing down or telling you something that would do that, or you didn't notice, which is interesting. And also, I said that the thing that multiplies to 32-bit values truncated them to 16 bits instead of 32 bits, which was just an error. So I have posted solutions to the lab on CoLab under the Resources tab. So if you want to refer to it for like doing Smooth, for example, they're there. And it includes all the exercises, so that might be useful. And from briefly glancing at a couple people's solutions and questions, some notes. So the underscore underscore M128i, that 128 bits of stuff type, do not use array indexing on it. So GCC has chosen to make array indexing on it do something, but they just arbitrarily chose a size, I think it's 32 bits, and they assume that that's what it's indexing, regardless of what size you're actually working with. And this probably won't work in other compilers like Clang, or might work inconsistently. So just don't, because it just doesn't know what size of values you're working with. If you want to extract a value, you can use the intrinsic mmextract and some pre-postfix depending on the size of value you want to get out, which turns into a particular instruction which has a constant and a register to, and another register to copy it to. Or you can store and load from an array on the stack. So also, a lot of people wrote code which did use this setr, which is with a bunch of array elements, which works and is not wrong, but is very slow compared to using a load, which loads 128 bits at once. And the problem is that GCC is not clever enough to notice, oh, AI and AI plus one and AI plus two, those are all next to each other in memory. It doesn't notice that. So the way it implements setr for that is it first copies element by element each thing you specify into 128 bits on the stack, and then it loads that. And that ends up being pretty slow. So instead use the direct load 128 bits altogether intrinsic. This is for Smooth especially, or else you'll have a huge performance problem. But the setr is useful for constants. For constants, GCC just like has a copy of the constant in the data section and loads it, which is great. But for if you have variables, it does something pretty inefficient. It does work. Your code probably produced correct results. It just does not doesn't actually generate efficient code. So those are my notes on the SIMD lab. So first, any questions on the SIMD lab or on Smooth? No, okay. So so just as a general point of view, so who thought the SIMD lab went good, kind of okay, or really bad? So a couple people thought a couple really bad, mostly good. Okay. So mostly good, some mediocre, a couple something really bad. Okay. So I'm obviously thinking about whether I'm going to do that next semester or how I'm going to change it. Like probably I gather that task 3 should have been optional given what people actually finished. My impression is most people didn't have too much trouble finishing task 1 and 2, and so Seems okay. Okay, so let's move on to address spaces then. So address spaces are about how we have this funny program layout here, where things are all in these locations we expect, which might have absolutely nothing to do with where they are in physical memory. If you recall, what we said is that whenever a program is running, there's this mapping set by the OS and evaluated by the hardware, where whenever the program accesses an address, that mapping is used by the hardware before it actually talks to real memory and before it uses a real memory address. So what we have is that we have program addresses, which we are going to call virtual addresses, go through this mapping and become real addresses, which we're going to call physical addresses. And these virtual addresses include every address the program accesses. This includes instructions and data. If there's a jump and it has an address in it, that's a virtual address. If there's a move and it has an address in it, that's a virtual address. Everything the program accesses goes through this mapping. And because we go through this mapping, it can be the case that program addresses and real addresses might be different sizes. So we could have bigger program addresses than the real addresses, and the mapping's going to somehow map them so to the smaller set of addresses, and if some of them are invalid, you know, that's what happens. Or some of them might map to the same thing. That's kind of necessary if you don't have as many in one bucket as the other. Or it could be the case that program addresses are smaller than the real addresses, that we have more memory than we actually can let any one program use at once. You can find real machines where either of these are true. And we have this mapping, and we're going to talk today about where it's stored. Is it stored in the processor? Is it stored somewhere else? And what format most modern systems have chosen to use for this mapping. So first, a note on virtual address sizes. So you would think that the size of a virtual address, well, you can figure that out because it must be the size of a pointer. When we're talking about virtual address size, we won't always be mean that. Because sometimes parts of the pointer aren't actually used to access memory. So for example, on 64-bit x86, pointers are 64 bits, but only 48 bits of the pointers are actually used to access memory, for put into the mapping. The other bits are ignored, except that they're required to all be the same thing. They're all required to all be copies of the next lowest bit. But they're otherwise not used for the mapping. You can't actually have use all the possible 64-bit values as addresses. And this is not an uncommon attribute because, well, you know, there's not actually that useful to have all 64 bits of the address, at least people have thought that in the past. So sometimes we'll talk about the sizes of address spaces. And I mean the amount of stuff that has addresses, basically the number of unique addresses times the amount of things each address references. So this means that if we have a 32-bit virtual address, it's a 2 to the 32 byte, assuming each address references a single byte, address space. And I'm going to say it's a 2 to the 32 byte virtual address space, even though essentially all the time, some of those addresses don't refer to anything, even though not all of them are valid. And the same is going to be true for physical addresses. If I have 20-bit physical addresses, I'm going to say I have a 2 to the 20 byte physical address space, that's the size of the space, even though perhaps not all of those addresses actually correspond to memory. And this is, in fact, a pretty common case. If my machine has 3 gigabytes of memory, that's not a power of 2, there must be some physical addresses which don't actually correspond to memory. When we talk about physical address space, we mean the space of possible addresses, not the space of addresses which actually correspond to something real. Okay. So that's a note on address sizes. And we'll start with an example of a really simple program. So here we're running a program where we have 10-bit virtual addresses. So really nice and simple, and our program has a bit of code, it has some writable data and a heap, it has either an empty space or where the heap might expand to, and a stack. So that's our memory layout. This is the entire address space that's visible to the program. And what we're going to do to support our address translation, our mapping, is we're going to divide this up into fixed size pages. And our pages are going to be exactly this division. So each page is going to be 256 bytes in this case. And I'm going to number the pages, these evenly sized chunks of memory, from 0 to 3. And so those are our division of the addresses the program sees. And you may notice, because I chose very deliberately that the size of each page is the power of 2, that if I want to know what page some addresses are in, I can just look at the upper bits of the address. And we'll call this the page number. Since our page size is a power of 2, if we just take off the bits corresponding to the page size, the page size is 2 to the 8, so we take off 8 bits, the rest is the page number. And that tells us which of these 4 regions of memory an address is in. The rest of the address we're going to call the page offset. So the size of the page offset is, in this case, 8 bits, because there are 2 to the 8 bytes in a page, and each one of them has a unique number, a unique offset, so we need 8 bits to store that. So we're going to have our virtual addresses, and that's going to map to real addresses. And on this machine, I have twice as many real addresses, and just like I divided my virtual addresses into these fixed size pages, I'm going to divide up my physical addresses into fixed size pages of the same size. So each of these pages are 256 bytes. I've labeled some of them with the range of addresses. The other ones I haven't labeled just to keep the slide less cluttered, but you can figure out what the labels should be. And just like with the virtual addresses, we can figure out the page number of each of these physical addresses by looking at the same upper bits of the address. We take off the bits corresponding to the page offset, the bits that vary within a page, and everything else is our physical page number. And what we're going to do to run this program to set up a mapping is our mapping is going to just say this page, this virtual page, corresponds to this physical page. We're just going to take whole pages all at once, are going to map in our map. And we need to represent that in some way. So let's write down what that mapping looks like. We basically have a table where for each virtual page, which I've represented by its binary index, which is the same as these upper bits of the address, we need to know what the physical page is. And so for example, because this is virtual page 0, I have an arrow to physical page 1111. So, to virtual page 010, if I follow my arrows correctly. So that's 010 in this table. And this structure is in fact called the page table. So it says for each virtual page, what physical page, if any, does it refer to? We notice that we have one case where it doesn't refer to any, and that was a case where we have a hole. And you remember that we have these spaces in our address space in a program where if you try to access memory, you get an error. that's how we're going to represent that. We're going to have a, just an entry which says there's no physical page for this virtual page. So questions about this mapping so far? So this is the mapping we're going to set up. So when we actually want to use that, we're going to first need to have the mapping in a form we can actually represent. And one thing is that since I need that none value, and I also have, you know, all three bits of my page number are used, I'm going to use an extra bit to store whether it's valid or not. So just like in caches, we have a valid bit to say whether a cache block stores data that's separate from the tag. We're going to have a valid bit that's separate from the physical page number that says whether this entry, as we're going to call them, of the page table actually corresponds to a real physical page. And what our CPU is going to do is whenever we get an address, we're first going to split it up into the page offset and the virtual page number. And we're going to do that by taking off bits corresponding to the length of our page offset. In this case, it's 8 because we have 2^8 byte pages. And the rest of the bits are our virtual page number. And we're going to look up the corresponding row in our page table. So we're going to take that out of our page table, and we're going to get this valid bit, and we're going to find out, is it valid? If it's not valid, we're going to trigger an exception, trigger what's called a page fault. If it is valid, we're going to take the other part of the entry, which is the physical page number, and we're going to use that as the first part of the memory address we actually want to access. We need the rest of the address, which is the page offset, so we're just going to copy the page offset from the original virtual address into our new physical address, just replacing the page number part. And this new address here is what we're actually going to send to the cache, and maybe to memory, depending on whether it's cached or not. So this is our general procedure for doing page table lookups and actually using this mapping that somehow the operating system is going to tell the processor about. And there's some terms here that we're going to use. So each row of this page table is called a page table entry. And I just mean the things we actually store, so the index isn't part of it because we're not going to write that down. We know where that what index it is by where it's stored in the page table. But the rest is going to be called the page table entry. The part of the virtual address that's the page number, we're going to call the virtual page number. We will sometimes abbreviate this as VPN. The part that's in the physical address, that's the page number, is called the physical page number, and we will sometimes abbreviate this as PPN. And the rest of the address, which is the same in both the virtual and physical case, is the page offset. So, any questions about this translation procedure? The assumption that we might have you do this by hand. Okay, so showing you our, we have a page table that's somehow set up for a program. And this is part of a process. So each process, because it has its own view of memory, it has different things at different than other processes at each address, potentially, you're going to have to switch page tables. And that's going to be part of the context switch. So there's going to be some extra privileged instructions in our processor. They need to be privileged because we don't want to just let anyone change their page table, because we don't want user A on the lab machine to be able to read stuff from user B's memory by changing the page table. These are going to be privileged instructions. and that it's going to be part of every context switch. So a tricky issue is, where do we put the code which contains these privileged instructions and switches page tables? And that's tricky because I told you, every time we access an address, we use the current page table to figure out what that address is. So generally, on most systems, we're going to have a page table entry that points to the code that we will actually run that does the context switch, because it needs to be somewhere in memory, and everything goes through this mapping. There's an alternative, which some systems implement, but is actually pretty uncommon, where you could imagine, on an exception, the hardware might change the page table for you. But that's actually pretty uncommon. The issue, if that we have this code in our page table of our program, which is not supposed to be able to change the page table itself, is what happens if it tries to modify that code, you know? So what? I can't execute the change page table instruction. Maybe I just edit the code that changes the page table to change it a little differently for me. No. Give me some extra permissions. And that would be really bad. That would let us escape user mode. So we're going to want a fix to that. And one fix is that we're going to add functionality to our page table. That we want parts of our page table which are just memory that's meant to be used by the OS. So a common solution that many real systems do is they'll add an extra column to the page table saying kernel mode only. And the way we'll use this is we'll do the same lookup we did before, but when we get our page table entry, which now has this kernel mode only bit, we'll check that bit and say, okay, if it's one and we're in user mode, I'm going to trigger a fault. This is called a protection fault. And this is a way that we can have that code be in the page table, but not worry about programs changing it while they're running in user mode, without having to have the hardware change the page tables for us in order to run our exception handler. Okay. So questions on this? And we'll see later on a whole bunch of extra stuff we'll add to the page table in addition to this, but this is simplest case. Okay, so I've shown you sort of a toy example with very small address spaces. So we're running a program in, you know, kilobytes, of less than a kilobyte of memory sort of thing. It's not what we actually want. So let's think of a real case. So let's say we have a 32-bit virtual address, the actual size of 32-bit x86, and we divide our address spaces, both physical and virtual, into 4,096 byte pages, or 2 to the 12 bytes, which is also the actual size on 32-bit x86. How many virtual pages do we have? So how? Anyone can tell me how I would figure this out? Yeah.
Yeah, so you'd have 2 to the 32 bytes of address space because it's a 32-bit virtual machine, and then you would divide that by 2 to the 12, which would then result in you subtracting the power, so it would eventually be 2 to the 12.
Yeah, so exactly. So we have 2 to the 32 possible bytes with names, and we divide them into chunks of 2 to the 12 bytes, so we just divide, and we get 2 to the 20, which, if you remember, is about 1 million. Okay. So let's say we have that, and we have about 1 million page table entries. And let's say we have a system with 30-bit physical addresses. So how big is our page table then? So anyone want to tell me what's the first thing I should try to figure out to answer this? Yeah.
You want to figure out the two address spaces, the virtual address space, and the size of the physical address space as well.
Yeah. So what do I want to know about the physical address space size?
So the physical address space size in this case is limited to less than the virtual address space.
Mm-hmm.
So my presumption is that you would take it as 2^30, not 2^32.
Okay. And that would we could do the same procedure to figure out based on there's 2^30 possible things with addresses. By 2^12 and find out that there's 2^18 physical pages. And that means that we need 18 bits, bits to have it to represent a physical page number. And that's going to be one of the things that's in our page table entry. So we have a physical page number, that's 18 bits. We have a valid bit, hopefully our valid bit is 1 bit. And we have a kernel mode bit, which is hopefully 1 bit. So this means that our page table entries are 20 bits. So it's 1 million entries times 20 bits, which is more than 2 megabytes. So given what I've told you, that's how much space it takes up. That might seem like a problem, and we'll get to that in a bit. So, yeah. Let's have this same setup. So we have 2^12 byte pages, which I told you is the real size on 32-bit x86. Here's an address. Let's split it into a page number and a page offset. So that was, remember, the first step when we were doing our lookup in the page tables. We need to extract the virtual page number so we could replace it with the physical page number. So we're going to want to split this up. So this address is somehow going to split up into a virtual page number, presumably virtual, and a page offset, which probably should not be written with a zero. So what can I find know about the sizes of those two things? What information do I have? So what's the page offset used for? Yeah.
Page offset's
12
bits.
12 bits. So why 12? Yeah, so this is going to be 12 bits. So it's going to be bits 0 through 11 of the address. And the rest is the virtual page number. And if you remember your hexadecimal, each hexadecimal digit corresponds to 4 bits. So it happens to be very convenient that 12 is a multiple of 4. So you split up the address into offset. Hex 678 and page number 12345 in hex. And this is basically a simpler version of the sort of splitting you were doing for caches. So we have this problem here that our page tables were huge. And this is real numbers from only a 32-bit system. So where can we keep those huge page tables? And well, you know, it doesn't seem like we can keep them on the processor because like megabytes is like the size of our biggest caches we ever have. Doesn't seem like a viable option. So we're going to keep them in memory. So we're going to choose a way to represent our page table entries as bytes of memory. So I here have chosen that each of my page table entries will be 2-byte values in memory. So I'll read basically a short from memory to get it. And I've chosen that certain bits of the short correspond to certain parts of the page table. So bit 15, the most significant bit of that short, is going to be the valid bit, then the kernel bit, then I have some bits which are the physical page number, and then I have some parts of it I'm not using. So I've chosen how I'm going to represent each page table entry as a 2-byte value in memory. And then the processor is going to want to use these, so I need to give the processor not the page table itself, but a pointer to it. So what we're going to store in the processor is what the book calls the page table base register, which is going to be a pointer to the page table entry for virtual page number 0. And after it, in memory, is going to be the entry for the next virtual pages and so on, page number 1, 2, 3, and so on. So we'll have memory. I'm here showing memory where I'm showing 2 bytes at once because that's the size of our page table entries. And that will be where our page table is stored. And so if you want to see for virtual page number 0, is it valid? We're going to look at the corresponding bit at that memory location. If you want to see if the kernel mode bit is set, we're going to look at the corresponding bit at that memory location. If we want to extract the physical page number, we're going to take those bits out of that part of memory and get it. And when we do this for the following entries, we'll be able to reconstruct our entire full page table. So we just go through and say, page table for virtual page 0 is at this address. The next 2 bytes are the page table entry for virtual page 1. The net following 2 bytes are the page table entry for virtual page 2, and so on, all the way up until we run out of virtual pages. Yes? It's a pointer to the page table entry for the virtual page number 0, for the first entry. And the page table here is just basically an array of page table entries, just like it would be in C. And that's probably, in fact, how the OS will be manipulating it. And we have a pointer to the first element of the array, just like we would in C. And you can just read out of memory what the values in each part of the page table are. And so this means that when our processor is evaluating the mapping, rather than being able to look up directly in the page table, it's going to have to use this page table base register and the page number to find the appropriate part of memory, read from that part of memory, interpret it as a page table entry, so it has to figure out where the page number is in it, and use that. So our procedure is going to look like we're going to take our virtual address. In this case, I have still a toy virtual address because I don't like writing 32 numbers on a box. But we're going to split it up into our page offset and page number. In this case, I have 2 to the 10 byte pages. So I have a 10-bit page offset. And I'm going to take that virtual page number here, and I'm going to multiply it times the size of each page table entry. And usually, you'll find that the size of each page table entry is a power of 2. And that's not a coincidence. That's because we want that multiplication to be really easy and just be shifting. And then we'll add the page table base register to it. So that's how we're going to find, we're finding the memory address of the page table entry for this page number. So once we have that, we're going to send that to our cache to fetch the appropriate page table entry. And the cache is going to possibly access memory, and eventually it's going to get us back that page table entry. In this, the example I showed you before, it's going to get us 2 bytes, and we're going to split that up into the various parts of the page table entry. And one of those parts is going to be the physical page number that would be part of the address. That when we are forming the address, that's going to be the top bits of the address we actually want to access based on what address the program had trying to access. We're also going to get things like our valid bit and our kernel bit, and we're going to check those versus, you know, whether we're in kernel mode and just the valid bit, whether it's 1. And if those don't have the right values, we'll trigger a fault rather than moving on. Assuming they do have the right values, we're going to take the page offset and we're just going to copy it from the virtual address to the physical address unchanged. And then we have our full physical address, that this is the address the program is actually going to access memory at, and we'll send that to the cache and access memory there. So this is when we are storing our page tables in memory, this is what our lookup procedure looks like. And the hardware which does it is called the Memory Management Unit, or MMU. So it's what takes the addresses and does the conversion. It needs to talk to the cache or memory in order to read the page table entries. It doesn't have them itself, because that would be too big to store directly on the processor, given the sizes that we've been talking about. And you may notice that this means that one program memory access can become 2. And that does seem like a problem. And in a week or two, we will resolve that problem. And in fact, it's actually a bit worse than that. When we're doing this MMU in the pipeline, we actually do it twice, sometimes. So if we have an instruction that doesn't seem to access memory, we still need to fetch it. So there's an MMU before we do the fetch from the instruction cache, and then there's an MMU before the memory, but we're not going to do anything there, so that's okay. But when we have an instruction that like moves a value from memory, we're going to access memory to read the page table entry to find out where the instruction really is. Then we're going to read the instruction from memory. Then we're going to access memory to find out where the memory is trying to access really is. Then we're going to read that memory. So that's 4 memory accesses and 1 instruction. And yeah, so we'll talk later about making this actually fast. But for now, this is the procedure we're doing, and yes, it's kind of slow. So, questions on this picture? Yeah?
So, can page table entries be put in a cache somewhere, or is it every single time?
So, yeah, if things work as in this picture, page table entries are in fact cached. And you notice that an attribute of this picture, which is deliberate, is that this cache only sees physical addresses. We never ever send a virtual address to the cache. We may or may not have time to talk about why that choice is made. It may be the case that some real processors don't cache page table entries, but in the cache, well, we might mention this issue when we talk about how we make the accesses fast. But for right now, the simplest design is that you cache the page table entry, so at least those 4 memory accesses might all be cache hits, which is a whole lot less bad than if they weren't. but it's still a big cost because we talk, like, cache hits are, on a modern processor are often like a couple cycles. And that seems like a cost we don't want to pay four times on every instruction, even if it's pipelined. Okay. So another issue is, so I talked about how big our page table was for like 32-bit x86. And 30-bit physical address space a while ago might have been a realistic size and didn't actually change the size much if we made it bigger. But, you know, that's not what we're dealing with today. So my desktop, I have a 39-bit physical address and 48-bit virtual addresses. This is 48 bits, not because the pointers are 48 bits. I don't run some exotic architecture you don't know about. They're 64 bits, but the top 16 bits in the pointer just aren't used for memory accesses. They're just discarded after checking that they're all the same as the 47 bit. So only 48 bits matter. So first of all, how large are page table entries? Or sorry, how many page table entries do we have in the system? So what was the procedure we used before to figure this out? Yeah?
Yeah, 2 to the 39.
So 2 to the 39 divided by 2 to the 12. So 2 to the 39, so we have 2 to the 39, so 2 to the 39, that's physical addresses. So page table entries are, there's one for each virtual address. Yeah. So, and 2 to the 48. So we have 2 to the 48 possible bytes we can address divided by 2 to the 12 bytes per page. Gives us 2 to the 36 pages, virtual pages. Which is the number of page table entries. And our physical page numbers, we're going to have 12 bits of the address because we have 2 to the 12 byte pages are going to be dedicated to the page offset. So we have 39 minus 12, which is a little less than 32 bits dedicated to physical page numbers. So physical page numbers are 27 bits. And apparently lag is a thing. 27 bits. So that's what we're dealing with. And in fact, on my real system, I'll just do this here so we can actually read what I have written. On my real system, it's the case that page table entries are 8 bytes because they want to store more than like 5 extra bits of stuff. They want to have room for a bigger physical address space in the future. So they're 8 bytes. Which means that if we multiply 8 bytes times 2 to the 36 entries, that's 2 to the 39 bytes. Seems like a real problem because that's half a terabyte. And my desktop does not have half a terabyte of memory, let alone half a terabyte of memory to devote only to not storing program data and just storing mappings. So that's obviously not what happens. I'm just going to mention that now. So for now, we're going to deal with these flat tables, but there's going to be something more efficient we're going to do. So we're going to get rid of the 2 extra cache accesses. The preview is we're going to use more caches to do it. And we're going to get rid of these problem of really, really huge page tables because I can't store 512 gigabytes of not programmed data on my system with like 32 gig of RAM, which is still a lot. And our solution for that is we're going to use something fancier than a flat table. But I'm going to start off with a flat table and doing the memory accesses directly just to keep things simpler. Okay. So we know the simple version of how paging works, so let's go through sort of a simple exercise here, which is going to be to translate some addresses. We're going to have a setup first. So I'm going to have a system, just to keep things nice and simple, where I have 5-bit virtual addresses and 6-bit physical addresses. Because my physical addresses are only 6 bits, I've given you a picture of the entirety of physical memory. All the values in physical memory. And I have my page table, which is apparently not stored in physical memory, or if it is, it's stored in some really clever way. We're not, because it doesn't really make sense for any of those patterns to match those page table entries. And I'm going to have 8-byte pages. So 8-byte pages means that I have 2 to the 3-byte pages, which implies I have 3-bit page offset. Which means that my 6-bit physical addresses have a 3-bit page offset and a 3-bit physical page number. And my 5-bit virtual addresses have a 2-bit, that's not readable, are going to be a 2-bit virtual page number and a 3-bit page offset. And in particular, since we have 8-byte pages, what this means from a picture point of view is that the first physical page is the first 8 bytes, the second physical page is the second 8 bytes. We number from 0, because we want to take the top bits of the address and the top bits start up at 0. So physical page 0 is the first 8 bytes, physical page 1 is the next 8 bytes, and so on. So given that, here's an exercise. So we have a page table, we have the addresses. If we access memory at these locations, what do we read given this page table? So I would recommend writing things down. So a good first step is to convert the addresses into binary and figure out what part of them is the page number. And you're allowed to talk with each other. It's not graded. Check your answers. To figure out where in the page we were. And the rest was used to find the page number. Which page? What? Yes. What? The 12 bits is where in a particular, you know the page, where in the page should we go? Yeah. Yes.
Okay, you should, why are you starting with 3? Instead of, are you
starting with your offset? So I highlighted the offsets, if that's what you're asking. And the rest is the page numbers. So who has any answer? Okay, so someone want to tell me one of the answers? Okay. Okay, so it accesses, this accesses 00. And how did you get that? So we can construct our physical address by replacing the virtual page number with that 000 we looked up and get the address, which is all zeros, which is these bytes here of 000. Sorry? So, yeah, so that's OX18, gets to be that. And so, and that's, it's the same procedure for each one. We split up, we pick off the page offset because we don't need it until the end. We're gonna put it back when we figure out the physical page number. And the rest of the address, after we remove the page offset from the end, is the virtual page number. And we look in the corresponding row of our page table. So in the case of our second address, that's going to be the virtual page number 00. When we look in that row, we find out we have physical page 010. And we replace that part of the address. So our address, new address is 010, and we copy the page offset, which is 011. And if we convert this back to hexadecimal, this becomes OX13. Which here is this, is 4A. So when we read from address 03, we actually get the value 4A at that address. Yes?
So when you're replacing it back into what you have, I get the part where you're doing that, but it doesn't matter what we cut off the extra five. So like with EOS 8-bit address, and we cut off the bottom five, right?
If it was an 8-bit, sorry.
Yeah, so like
So the question is the amount we cut off for the page offset?
Yeah, then when we...
That depends on the page size only.
Yeah, but when we put the physical page number back in for it, mm-hmm. and combine with the offset,
yeah.
do we add that back to it, or like add, the hexadecimal?
Do we add what back to it?
Do we add what we cut off?
Which part we cut off, the page offset, or...
Off of the original, like, so if we had like 0x1a,
yeah.
0011000.
0001100.
Yeah, we cut off the bottom three zeros.
Yeah.
We get the 5 bits. Right.
So, in this problem, I've told you to assume we have 5-bit virtual addresses. So I wrote this as 2 hexadecimal digits because I didn't want to write them in binary. But the setup of the problem is telling you that we don't actually have 8 bits.
Yeah.
So the addresses are really 5 bits. It doesn't really change how you do the problem if you think of it that way, because you still look in the same row on the table, because if we only have 5 bits, we're not going to set the leading zeros to ones. So you still look in the same place on the table. So it doesn't change anything as far as what answer you'll get. Because the things where it would differ don't exist anywhere on the chart, right? There's no page table entries for those for addresses which would have non-zeros in the bits before the top ones. There's no physical addresses which have entries which would not have zeros in those top bits. Is that, you look confused?
I was just asking about converting back to hex.
So converting back to hex,
yeah.
Like, oh. So do you put back the zero? Well, I mean, it doesn't matter. It's still the same value in hex, right? Like, you could convert back to hex by converting the binary to decimal and then converting that to hexadecimal. I don't recommend it, but you better get the same result. And so for converting back to hex, the easiest way to think about it is probably just to add leading zeros, because it doesn't change the value in hexadecimal. The addresses themselves, of course, don't have extra leading zeros, because they're 5 and 6 bits. Okay, other questions? Okay, so we can continue this procedure for the other parts of this. So for here, our page number is 01, that turns into physical page 1111, and we copy the rest, 010, and this is 0x3a, which is right here. And so we read DC for that. Yes?
Well, we need to know how to convert from binary to hexadecimal.
The question is, would we need to know how to convert from binary to hexadecimal? This seems like I would recommend knowing how to do it. Okay. So we get OXDC by doing that conversion. For this last one, we have 10, which is this entry of the page table, which has a valid bit of zero. So this is a fault. It's not a valid memory location. Okay, so now that I have all the answers written down, any questions about having any of this procedure? Yes?
How do you get 3A from 1110?
So 111010. So you want to split it up into 4-byte chunks for easy conversion to hexadecimal. And you add some leading zeros, and it's relatively straightforward. Then I do need to remind myself that A is one that pattern, not something else. But other questions? Yes.
What's the last number in the physical address?
the last physical for 1-3? For hex 1-3, you mean? What's the physical address? Sorry?
For the first entry, we have 0x00f3. So what's f3?
F3 where? The first f3 we have. You're asking what this is? What? Sorry, I. Here? EC, that's hex EC, but to the left, what's this represent?
Yeah.
This is saying that is physical addresses with address hex 3C, hex 3E, hex 3E, hex 3F. So the first byte here is hex 3C, second byte is hex 3D, and so on. That is maybe not entirely obvious, but. So other questions about anything on this picture? Okay, apparently not yet. Okay, so that's sort of the basic operation of page tables. And we're gonna talk about some additional features we're gonna add. So first, a motivational example. So let's say you're logged into LabUnix 1, you're running Emacs, someone else is logged into LabUnix 1, it's running Emacs. So we have two copies of Emacs, each with their own page table, and they have their own memory layout, but they actually have different copies of all the memory. And something which kind of seems like a shame is that we have this code for Emacs, and it seems like we're going to have two copies of it. Because we said that each page program has independent memory. And we like to only have one copy. So that seems like a good idea because this is the same data. It should be the same data no matter what the program's doing. So we'd like to do that, but this is not actually something we can do for free. And the problem is, you know, Emacs is not supposed to change its code plus constants, but what if it did? What if there was a bug in Emacs and you caused Emacs to do that? This would break the process abstraction because now you triggering a bug in your copy of Emacs would break someone else's Emacs program, which is definitely not supposed to happen. You aren't supposed to be able to influence things that aren't yours. But this is actually a very useful thing that we want to do on real systems. We want to be able to run multiple copies of programs and have multiple copies of the data, but not have them interfere. And a solution to this is that we can enforce the idea that Emacs is not going to modify its code. We can make sure that happens, and therefore make sure that your copy of Emacs won't see what some other copy of Emacs' bug changes as a constant to be the wrong value, even though it's not supposed to. And a way we can do this is by adding more what are called permissions bits to page tables. So you saw this with that kernel mode bit. You have this special bit to indicate kernel mode only can do this. To keep us safe, we're not going to let other things access it, and we use that to check things like the code that switches the page tables. We'll also have bits for, like, can you write this? So we can map, we can set in the page table that these pieces of the same data map to the same physical pages, so we don't store it twice in memory, but we set them not writable, so you don't have to worry what if there's a bug in Emacs and it tries to overwrite its code or constants. We don't have to worry about that. If there's such a bug, we'll get a fault. We can crash Emacs or do something else in response to it, rather than having user XYZ see the results of that bug that user MST exploited. And we'll typically have this for some other things. For example, it's common for there to be an executable bit in the page tables, which just says, do we allow you to fetch instructions from this address, from this page table entry? And if you take, for example, Defense Against the Dark Arts, you'll learn something about why these sort of things are useful. So we saw a simple example of sharing code, which is we're running two copies of the same program. We'd like not to have two copies of absolutely everything, since a lot of the stuff is in common. There's actually more things in common than that. One case is the C standard library. So the C library has a lot of code that is really handy, like printf and fopen and qsort and things like that. And we would like not to have multiple copies of it in memory. And our solution, and this is what many real OSs do, is we're going to have multiple virtual read-only copies which are backed by the same physical pages. So we'll have different programs, we'll have page table entries for the C standard library, but they'll all actually point to the same physical pages, so you don't actually have to have five different copies of the C standard library actually loaded at a time to run five different programs. Or if you like think of lab Unix 1 on a busy time, like 100 copies, 1,000 copies, you don't need to do that. This actually requires some changes to how programs work. So if we recall, when we talked about linking, we had these placeholders to fill in addresses, and they changed based on where the library ended up. And that's a bit of a problem, because we're going to want to put the library possibly in different places in different programs, or we're going to have to do a lot of work to make sure we can always put it in the same place, no matter what the library is. And the common solution that's used on Linux for this is something called position-independent code, that we compile the library in a way where it doesn't matter where it's loaded in memory. Just to support this idea that multiple programs can load it, and they can have a different spaces they use to load it, depending on what memory layout they need to run. This means you have to change the code. So for example, in Y86, our jumps were encoded with the target address. That does not work very well for this. So one thing that some architectures, including 64-bit x86 support, is another way of encoding jump, where you have the target address minus the program counter, which means that you have the same value no matter where the jump is located in memory, assuming the other code you're jumping to is part of the same chunk of memory. So this handles jumps within the standard library. And it's typically how that sort of code will be compiled. And it's not just the C library. If you look at a typical program on Linux, there's a tool called LDD, which will tell you, here are all the libraries this program loads when it starts. And for a program which you would think is not very complicated, which is LS, there's a lot of them. It also tells you what addresses, where in this page table, they're going to have entries for that library. And so this is enabled because we can put these page table entries in that location and just set them as read-only, so we don't care what other processes have that map to. And because we've compiled the code carefully, we can have it work no matter where we have to load it. You know, because there might be multiple libraries, we can't, don't know exactly where it's going to end up. The other tricky part of this, besides the issue of I have to load this library anywhere, is we need to handle things like calls between libraries, we need to handle different versions of libraries, so we don't actually know where the functions we want to call are going to be loaded. Because like, let's say I upgrade libc and printf changes size. So in order to make that work, a common strategy, not the only one, is to have a lookup table which is not shared between programs, which tells you where the library ended up being loaded, including and where each function is, and use that at runtime to call the functions. And this is typically what happens on Linux, something like this. And the idea here is that even though we have some extra data, we're getting a big win because we don't have multiple copies of the same library loaded at the same time. Also, we have the advantage that you can upgrade the C library without recompiling every program on your computer. So then that's called dynamic linking. So overall, we've talked about how page tables work, that we have, you know, our generic address translation idea that we have program addresses, which we call virtual addresses, and we have real addresses, which we call physical addresses, and we're going to do some translation between them. And the virtual memory choice is that we divide memory up into these fixed size chunks called pages. We choose a size for each page, and we just say memory is composed of a sequence of pages. And each page in virtual memory, each page the program sees, maps to a single page in physical memory. And we control this with page table entries, which tell us the location of the physical page, whether it's valid or not, so we can have holes in our virtual memory, which is pretty common when you're running a program, that not all addresses will be valid. And also has these things, permission bits, so we can control what programs can do, which lets us do things like sharing code between multiple programs without worrying about the programs writing over the code. And all these page table entries are stored in a page table. And this is what the processor actually accesses to do memory accesses at runtime. And whenever there's a permission or validity error, this triggers an exception. In particular, it triggers some kind of fault. And as we learned about exceptions, the idea of exceptions is that this is the processor asking, hey, operating system, what do I do here? And what we've typically talked about is that when there's an exception, that means the program did something wrong, and we're going to kill it. That was our typical case. But we don't have to do that. And we saw an example of that Tuesday when I talked about one way you can implement virtual machines, is that when you have a fault saying you tried to use a privileged instruction, the operating system could have its handler for that instead of just crashing your program. It could do something like the instruction you were trying to use. And we can use a similar idea with the faults we get from page tables. Whenever we find out the page wasn't valid or it had the wrong permissions, it was read-only and you tried to write to it, the OS doesn't need to just crash the program. It can do something else, and it can make, therefore, memory seem to have capabilities that it really can't have by itself. I'm going to call these page table tricks. And the idea is that when you have one of these faults, that the fault handler, that part of the operating system, instead it's going to change the page table in some way and then rerun the thing which caused the fault, and hopefully it will work and do something useful. And by using this, we can implement this fancy functionality which makes memory seem to do things which would not be possible with normal physical DRAM. And that's what we're going to start talking about next Tuesday.